Support for WKAR is provided by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening. The Fowler Farms Project has cleared another hurdle in Clinton County. This is according to the State Journal's Stephen Reed. You may be aware of this, but you may not. A Chicago-based wind energy company wants to build 39 towers. They would like them to be 427 feet tall, and this would all be on farmland. In Clinton County, they'd be in three townships, Essex, Dallas, and Bengal townships. Now, issues remain with the three townships. Those three reportedly have more restrictive zoning requirements than the county. So there's still important discussions ahead, but last night's 5-2 vote by the Clinton County Board of Commissioners apparently granted a special land use permit to the wind energy company, which apparently allows the whole process to continue. Kirk Heinze, there's a story for us. Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero's State of the City address on Monday night offered an uplifting assessment of the capital city. With the new Board of Water and Light facility as a backdrop, the mayor said Lansing is powered up thanks to falling unemployment, rising home sales, and a series of manufacturing and development successes. He urged listeners to take advantage of momentum to address the city's financial challenges and improve public safety. And here to respond and to discuss the city's challenges and opportunities is Carol Wood, longtime city council member and newly reelected president of the city council. Always nice to see you, Carol.
It's nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us on Current State. What do you make of our new studio?
It is gorgeous. You know, I can remember being cramped in some other spaces, so this is very nice.
We clean up rather well.
I think you do.
I spoke with the mayor a couple of days before the State of the City and asked him if positive news out of the city outweighs the challenges the city faces. Not surprisingly, he said, absolutely. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, we have a number of things that are positive that we can crow about. And as we look at other communities around us, do we have challenges out there? Absolutely. And I think we have to look those square in the face and look at coming up with some solutions for those.
What's on your short list of challenges?
Well, neighborhoods. You know, I keep trumpeting that issue over and over again. I think the idea of bringing jobs and everything is wonderful, but if you have a workforce that's in our neighborhoods that are buying our houses, that are sending their children to our schools, you will see that retail as well as manufacturing will come because we have a workforce. So we've got a lot of work to deal with in our neighborhoods, especially with the foreclosures, the fact that we've reduced services, and that's made a difference in how the neighborhoods look as you drive through them today.
How much credit does the mayor deserve for the good things that are happening in Lansing?
Well, I think it's a combination. The mayor definitely has brought those forward to council, but it is a matter of council approving those. And we've asked the tough questions many times, and together we've embraced the changes and looked at making differences for Lansing. So I think it's a cooperative effort, and we'll continue to try to do that balancing act.
Does he deserve blame for the shortcomings in the neighborhoods that you refer to?
Well, the foreclosure rate is not Mayor Bonero's fault. Cutting some of the services and how we allocate dollars, some of those changes, there is some blame that I think not only from his perspective or some of the budgets that were passed by council have an effect on those. So I think it's a little of both.
The mayor emphasizes that the city's long-term future, perhaps even its capacity to avoid eventual bankruptcy, hinges on getting long-term legacy-type costs under control and by eliminating structural deficits. To what extent do you share that worry?
Well, it is extremely important out there. But I think one of the things that we have to continuously look at is we don't make widgets. We are not making hamburgers where I can put less lettuce on a hamburger. We give services. Services mean people. And so part of what we do means that we're going to have personnel out there doing those services. And if people want fire protection and police protection and their garbage picked up, it doesn't happen automatically. It means that we have to pay for those employees. Part of this is negotiating contracts and working with unions to come up with ideas to reduce expenditures and come up with additional revenues. And those are things that we'll have to continue to look at. And again, we shouldn't be spending outside our means, and we should be looking at different ways that we are spending money to see if there are programs and things that we can do cooperatively with other municipalities, along with if we can get volunteer help on some of those issues.
This was not in the State of the City address, but last week I asked Verge about the possibility of service cuts and if they would be necessary to address next year's projected $9 million deficit. Here is part of his answer.
Somewhat, but not really. The plan is to continue to provide quality services, but just probably have to do it in a new way. There may be some things. I mean, for example, a while back we stopped doing tree stump grinding. So in that respect, there may be some services around the edges. There'll probably be some fee increases. But there may be some things that we do differently. I mean, the goal is to keep the quality of service, but to be open to doing it differently.
You share that view to any extent? I mean, it seems like you do.
Yes, I think there are things that we can look at and at doing differently. One of the things that I've heard repeatedly by employees and some of the public is our garbage service. Right now, we have three different services, the city, waste management, and Granger coming through our city at different times during the week. Looking at what East Lansing does, where it is all a city service. Is that something that we could look at? And could we do it cheaper and have less wear and tear on the roads? It would make a difference with having garbage out on one on a street and the fact that you'd only have containers out once during that week instead of all week long, getting knocked over, ending up in the street. I mean, those are issues that we should be looking at.
You expect that to happen?
Well, I know it's one of the things that council has talked about, and Derek Quinney is chair of Public Service Committee, and I know that's one of the things he wants to look at this year.
You would support that, though?
Yes, I think I would.
The state, we're talking with the president of the Lansing City Council, Carol Wood. The State Journal reported last Sunday that one member of the city's financial health team, Steve Lydell, told them that among the list of suggestions being reviewed by the financial health team was moving city employees from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, like a 401k, privatization of services, including possibly the Board of Water and Light, and a bunch of others. Do any of those give you pause, or would you be on board with any of those proposals?
Well, first of all, we have settled one union contract that went to a hybrid defined contribution for new employees that are coming in. I think one of the misnomers, though, that people have a tendency to forget is with a defined benefit plan, there is money coming into that plan that the employees pay along with the city. If you were to immediately stop the defined benefit plan, there are still legacy costs for the retirees that we currently have in that plan. So the city would still be making contributions. It might be a short-term fix, but in the long term, they would still have that money that they'd have to be paying. So unions are looking at this, they are negotiating, and we've seen this with one contract. As far as selling the Board of Water and Light, absolutely do not support it. I can't be more, vocal about that. When we look at how we kept GM here and some of the businesses that we have attracted here, it's because we have a public utility. It's because our rates are less than what the private utilities are, and we can use that as a selling factor when we're selling Lansing.
Anything else to say with regard to privatization of services, though? What is being handled by the city now that would arguably be better handled by the private sector?
Well, and I have mixed feelings on that. I think that our workers and employees are doing an excellent job. Again, I think they have a number of suggestions that can help decrease expenditures and raise revenues. I don't think our employees are the problem. I think they're the solution. And many times what we've seen in privatization is what ends up happening is you might get a low bid and decide to change your services over to that. But over time, then when you've gotten out of the equipment and you've reduced your employees, those costs go up over a long-term process. So I need to examine those issues and look at them very closely.
How do you close the $9 million budget deficit, though, for 2014? I mean, you're legally maxed out on mills, as far as I can
tell. Just about.
Close
very,
to it.
Very close. I think one of the misnomers, when you hear that number out there, it's based on how we're doing government right now. And that's not correct. When those numbers were given to us by the administration, that was a 40-hour work week. That was with raises that had been negotiated. That was having all the service, all the positions that are on the books filled, and we have many vacancies right now. Right now, for the last 6 years, we have had furlough days. Those were not figured into that.
You're saying the deficit effectively for 2014 is less than $9 million?
Yes, it is less than $9 million.
How much less? Do you have an idea?
No, I don't have an actual calculation of what that is. We have asked for some numbers. We've asked, and as a matter of fact, on February 4th, we're going to be having our auditors in talking about our outside audit for last year. The administration will also be talking about their second quarter numbers, and that will be held in council chamber at 6:30. It's a committee of a whole meeting, and that will be televised. And it's one of the things that we have to look at and talk about real numbers, not as if we were doing everything the same as usual. We have made cuts, we have made changes, and we should be looking at that budget picture with that in mind. We also have a number of union contracts that are up, and the health care will be changed in those based on the state statutes and the changes that were made there. So we'll be looking at either a hard cap or an 80-20 with those union contracts. That will continue to decrease what that deficit is right now.
But the number that comes up at the February meeting will still not include the kinds of changes that you feel ought to be included in those projections, correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Interesting. With regard to service sharing, consolidation, and the like, how eager or how reticent are adjoining cities and townships to engage in these discussions?
Well, I think that there have been a number of things that we already do together. There's a number of fire training things that we do together. We do a number of police trainings together. We have worked on our mutual aid and some of those issues together. But I think one of the things is there has to be a trust factor in there. Let's talk about Lansing Township as an example.
Okay.
We have a sewer agreement that we've worked out with them where we provide their sewer services for them, and they pay for that with us. But then in the next breath, when we're calling names or saying they shouldn't exist, it makes it difficult for them to sit down.
You're
at
referring
the table.
To the mayor.
Yes, I am referring to the mayor. I think, you know, first what we have to do is have a mutual respect for the entities that are around us and the elected leaders that are around us to be able to have some cooperation as we sit down and talk about these services.
when I asked the mayor what his relationship, his working relationship was with you now, here a couple of days ago, here at the beginning of another year, he said it was as good as ever. Now, that doesn't sound like a real glowing recommendation of the current dynamic, to tell you the truth, but talk to us about that. I know you had breakfast together, you had a meal together, you broke some kind of bread.
Well, actually, I offered to buy breakfast. We have not, you know, actually had the breakfast yet, but we have had a meeting. We had an hour and a half meeting. We walked out of there with no bloodshed. In fact, we both talked about who was going to do the press release on it so that everyone knew that we had had this private.
And then blood was spilled, right? No, I'm doing the press. No, you're doing the press release.
So, you know, that was, I think, building on the relationship. Next week, we will be having another meeting with him as council leadership. Our first one was a private meeting, just the two of us. We talked about some of our issues and the things that we'd like to see from each other, both understanding what those things were, and we tried to put the past behind us.
Did you discuss any intention you might have to run for mayor again?
Actually, he did bring that up, but I did not talk about what my feelings were and what I was going to do in that capacity.
Have you decided in the meantime?
Yes, I have decided. I'm not going to be seeking the mayor's job this year. I have a lot on my plate when we look at council and what we have before us this year as president. I believe that you need to be putting all of your energies toward that and making the difference that will make a difference for Lansing right now.
Well, we've been on the air with our new program. We're in our third week. I don't know how we made it to our third week, and it took all this time to get you on the program here because you're at the center of so much of what's going on in Lansing. Carol Woods, president of the Lansing City Council, we really appreciate your time, and we'll see you again soon.
We'd love to come back.
Thanks. Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Lansing's first business incubator, the NEO Center, recently marked its first anniversary. The center hosts a number of nascent enterprises that include such cutting-edge pursuits as scientific visualization, intellectual property development, and web data migration. And the NEO Center's founder is a local, self-described serial entrepreneur, Tom Stewart, who joins us to discuss the NEO Center and his other business, Commonwealth Enterprises. And he's joined by his Commonwealth Enterprises colleague, Catherine Mooney, to discuss the dynamics of business startups in Lansing. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Welcome to Current State. I forgot to mention there's a T-shirt company at the NEO Center, too. So we've got scientific visualization, web data migration, and T-shirts.
Yeah.
We have an interesting mix of the old and new economies going on at the NEO Center.
We absolutely do.
You grew up in
Bath.
Bath?
Yep, I'm from Bath originally.
You don't get much more local than that.
You don't.
So just so all of our listeners are up to speed, give us a good basic working definition of business incubator.
Well, business incubator is a space for budding entrepreneurs to come and kind of sandbox their ideas and get started. We provide, you know, access to all the things a new entrepreneur would need to be successful. So sometimes that means access to lawyers, accountants, HR help, and again, sometimes even like startup capital if we have access to that to provide them to it. It also usually means with an incubator, it's not just a discount space. It's also usually involves some sort of programming, some type of educational curriculum that provides them a path to be successful. And then on top of that, there's usually a timeline of their stay in the space. So you can't just be there indefinitely. Usually it's between a year and a half and 3 years.
Now, are business incubators a recent concept? I mean, I seem to have heard about them maybe in the past 10 years. They really seem to be talked about an awful lot. Or have they been around for a while?
They've been around for close to around the 70s. They weren't called business incubators then, but they've been becoming quite hot now in the, you know, with the resurgence of entrepreneurship in Michigan and general in the nation. Incubators are kind of becoming like a buzzword or a new hotspot. I think that what helps that actually is technology. Now we have the ability and the capacity to, you know, work from just about anywhere, doing just about anything. So these kind of co-working spaces and collaborative spaces are much more able to provide needs for the entrepreneurs.
And the serial entrepreneur label requires that you have at least a half dozen things going on simultaneously. Maybe it's a dozen. I don't know. Your main gig is with a company you formed called Commonwealth Enterprises. And interestingly, Commonwealth is two words.
Yes.
Commonwealth.
That's correct.
Enterprise. Not one word, but two words. What is Commonwealth Enterprises' main business?
Our main business is actually helping people start businesses. That's the easiest way to say it. We do pre-seed investment in companies between the startup phase, so anywhere like zero, not even started or formed yet, to about 18 months to, again, about 36 months. And then we provide management consulting and business development consulting kind of as our role there.
So you see these things really start to get on their feet in the NEOS Center, but once they reach a certain threshold, you might step in as Commonwealth Enterprises and take the business over?
That's absolutely correct.
Buy out the business.
Correct. We take a small stake in it. We actually, NEOS Center was actually a scratch-your-own-itch kind of problem for Commonwealth Enterprises, right? Since I am a local and I love the Lansing area, I wanted to be able to make investments in the Lansing area, and really there weren't a whole lot of new companies being formed in Lansing at the time we got involved or got started with Commonwealth Enterprises. So we said to ourselves, how do we create an environment here in Lansing in which we could make more investments? And kind of a small business incubator was a natural fit, and we went about, you know, making sure that happened.
Gotcha. And Catherine, what's your role at Commonwealth Enterprises?
So officially, I'm Commonwealth Enterprises' senior consultant, which means that I pop in to make sure that our tenant businesses or our investment businesses are kind of on the right track. Making sure that they're feeling not only that they have access to the resources that Commonwealth provides, but they feel supported in pursuing those resources and can be connected to other entrepreneurs or people in the area that can help them achieve their goals.
Back to the NEOS Center, though. It's been just over a year since you launched. Are you pleased? Are you frustrated? How's it unfolding?
We're extremely pleased, actually. The teacher company that you were talking about, they formed another company, they were with another company called Ocean View, and actually they were successful enough that they received some outside funding and have now graduated out of there. We've had another company just recently, Flight Lead Leadership Development, who have graduated out of our program, moved on to a bigger space because she was expanding. So we're extremely pleased with what's happening in just a year. We've gotten national coverage again from The Atlantic coming down to see us. And there's only more to come here.
The Atlantic Magazine did a story about the NEOS Center.
They did.
Tell us about that.
They were doing kind of a tour across mid-Michigan, and we got on their email list. And they contacted us and said, hey, some people said this is something we should check out, and we're going from, you know, basically Chicago to Grand Rapids to Ann Arbor, and we were thinking maybe we should stop in Lansing. You should definitely come check out our space. And they did, and they loved it, and they gave us some coverage. So we were really excited to see that, and I can't remember the headline off the top of my head, but it was, I think, a new kind of incubator for a new kind of Lansing.
What issue? How long ago did that appear?
It was early fall, I believe.
Early fall.
Late summer, early fall.
Okay. All right. We're talking with Tom Stewart. I beg your pardon. Tom Stewart of Lansing's NEOS Center, the city's first business incubator, and his colleague at Commonwealth Enterprises, Catherine Mooney. Can you stick around and talk some more with us after NPR News?
We'd love to.
More from Tom Stewart and Catherine Mooney of the NEOS Center and Commonwealth Enterprises. Also, we talk with the BBC Symphony Orchestra's Keith Lockhart here on Current State. And it's our weekly Neighbors in Action segment. Also on the way, we take a look at tonight's Count of the Homeless here in Lansing. That is scheduled for tonight. Coming up on Current State here on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. You see Coach Izzo today. Wish him a happy birthday. Tom Izzo, 58 years old today. Happy birthday, Tom. We're visiting with the NEO Center's founder, Tom Stewart. The NEO Center was Lansing's first business incubator, which launched just over a year ago. Tom Stewart, along with his colleague, Catherine Mooney, who is also involved in Tom's main business, which is Commonwealth Enterprises. Did you set a specific goal? You have how many tenants at the NEO Center right now?
We have 12 tenants right now.
12. Did you set a specific goal for the NEO Center when you're in this business, or, and have you hit it, or are you on your way?
Our specific goal is to be all the way full, and we are on our way. We waver right just around the 90% full. There are a few of our workstations that we just can't quite fill, but we're pivoting on that. We're actually going to close those workstations off into private office spaces. So when we built this space, we kind of did some focus studies about whether flexibility was more important than privacy, and they kind of were right around the same. They were weighted about the same, so we created some flexible workstation space. But when it comes down to actually leasing them, people like the privacy more than they like flexibility quite a bit more, actually. So we're going to close those off and hopefully be able to lease those right up.
What is full? Is it 18?
There's 20? 21. There's 21 spaces in the building. There's two businesses that actually take more than one space up. So we're trying to get as many businesses as we can in there. So the 12 other 12 businesses we've leased in there. They've leased about, I think, 19 of the 21 spaces.
Tell us another story about one of your are they called tenants?
They are called tenants.
Okay. Tell us another story about one of your tenants that would illustrates what you're all about and maybe something promising.
Oh, absolutely. I'm actually going to use one of our non-traditional what would be a non-traditional incubator tenant, and they're Green Lawn Landscapes. So they're a landscaping company, and she came to us wanting to kind of restart her landscaping business. And when you usually think about incubators, a lot of times it's about innovative technology,
web data migration, intellectual property development,
stuff like that. So I actually was originally not on board with bringing her into the incubator, but we met as our board. And we talked about it, and really we started talking about, what are we actually trying to accomplish here with NEO Center? And it was actually what we're trying to do. Lansing's kind of behind the ball as far as the startup community goes in the state of Michigan. Grand Rapids is quite a ways ahead with Start Garden and the DeVosses, and Ann Arbor's been doing the startup community thing since the 80s. So really in Lansing, what we're trying to do is inspire and create an environment where entrepreneurship or anyone can create a business. So for that, and that NEO Center can provide access for that. So when we were talking about Green Lawn, we were like, actually, she's a perfect fit, because really we just wanted anyone to be able to start a business. We want people to know that Lansing is a great place to start a business and that there are resources here available for anyone, not just technology businesses, not just web-based businesses. Anyone who wants to start a business in Lansing can start a business here.
Tom, your bio on the NEO Center website describes you as a community activist as well. Do you feel the NEO Center's mission is activism, or are you referring to other activities you have going
on? I'm primarily referring to other activities that are going on, but NEO Center also, one of our core values is to do good, and when we're not, that's not a grammatical error as do well. We are actually trying to be actively engaged in the Northtown neighborhood revitalization. So in the long run, we're going to be doing or helping with the needs assessment of the Northtown Neighborhood Association in the Northtown neighborhood, and then trying to figure out how to actively engage our tenants, part of their curriculum, part of their programming that will go along with NEO Center World, to see how they can actually be engaged, making or requiring the tenants to be engaged in the revitalization efforts, whether that's painting lampposts or planning a community garden, whatever ends up being outlined in that needs assessment. We're going to try to get our tenants engaged in that.
You ran unsuccessfully for Lansing City Council a year and a half ago. Why did you run, and are you thinking about running again?
I ran primarily because I wanted to see change, and I think I thought the small business and entrepreneur community's voice was underrepresented on the council. I thought I could be effective there and represent a different demographic, and I wanted to do that.
And Catherine ran your campaign, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
I will probably run again at some point, not this year, and we don't know in 2 years, but I have I believe really to create systemic change, right, you have to be engaged on all levels, and while a lot of entrepreneurs and business people will turn a blind eye to politics and be like, oh, I would never do that in a million years, I can do that, you know, I can make change through my business, I think you can do that, but I think if you want to create exponential change instead of incremental change, again, you have to be engaged on all levels, and I think that's why I would like to continue pursuing my political options.
Very good. This has been a fun segment. Tom Stewart of the NEO Center and Commonwealth Enterprises, along with his colleague, Catherine Mooney. We'll have you back, okay?
Awesome. Thank you.
Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Each Wednesday on our Neighbors in Action segment, we feature a person or organization that's working to make our community a better place. Today, we delve more deeply into Lansing's homeless population. Now, later tonight, teams of social service workers will fan out across the city to reach out to people in dire need. Every January, the Point in Time Census tracks homelessness in the region. The teams will seek out people living without shelter and offer them food, clothing, and a place to stay. Some people accept the offer, others refuse, choosing instead to battle the elements and sometimes their addictions alone. And I'm joined now by Mark Chris, the executive director of the City Rescue Mission in Lansing, which is coordinating the Point in Time Census. How are you, Mark?
Good morning, Mark. Doing great, thanks.
Great. There are a handful of common images that come to mind when we talk about homeless people, often addicted, often male, often mentally ill. How much accuracy, how much inaccuracy to that image?
Well, I think that image is true a couple of decades ago. And I probably 15 years ago, I started getting involved with City Rescue Mission, volunteering to serve a meal. And I started seeing that my stereotype was exactly what you mentioned. I thought 40-year-old middle-aged men, alcoholics, drug addicts.
Yeah.
What I didn't know was that there's a lot of women and children that are also homeless or coming to the mission for a meal, coming to the mission for a bed as well. And I think that's the stereotype is changing. The largest population of homelessness today are families. They're typically moms with children that are becoming homeless and need assistance. It's not the middle-aged man that's an alcoholic or a drug addict, but it's certainly still a stereotype. People automatically assume that. And so as you start to investigate, especially this survey by example, what we're going to do is we're going to look at sheltered people as well as unsheltered people. Now, the unsheltered people are typically the ones that are living in addictions and drugs and alcohol, and they typically are male, and they're a very small percentage of female adults that are living in addictions outside of the shelter environment. Typically, these are people that don't want to follow rules, don't want to stay in a nice, warm, clean place with a good meal. They'd rather battle the elements because of their addiction. That's a very small percentage. I'd say a very small percentage of those people that are living addiction that are homeless. A higher percentage of people, probably 60% of the people that we take care of, are actually women and children that are homeless.
Well, Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke yesterday with Trudy Taylor, who's currently residing at your shelter for women and children. Here's a little clip of what she had to say about her experience.
I seen women come in here crying because they can't believe it happened to them. I seen teachers, I seen nurses. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But, you know, after they come in and they meet other people going through the same thing, making the same mistakes they made, and end up in the same place, they be like, oh, okay, I know not to do that again. But then you have to learn what you should have done.
Trudy Taylor, who our Kevin Lavery spoke with yesterday. Do you know Trudy?
Tell us a little bit more about her
journey.
She's very helpful in trying to help out in the facility, help with the other women. help guide them, lead them know, let them know what to expect. I think that the first thing that women do when they come to the mission is they're very surprised how clean and safe it is. And that's a critical piece. If you're a woman with children looking for a place to stay, you want it to be safe. That's number one. Clean is important. We provide a wonderful facility for women and children. It's never what they expect. It's always above and exceeds their expectation of when they stay there. So we've got to make sure we meet that element. But women like Trudy help these other ladies become more comfortable with what they have to do to get on their feet, to get work, to get housing, to get shelter. And typically a mom's with us probably 3 or 4 months. And so it is a challenge. It's a huge change. And most people never thought it would happen to them. And oftentimes it is your neighbor. It's the one example, my wife babysat for a child many years ago. Fast forward 20, 30 years, his mom and dad are doctors, and he's homeless. He's a crack addict, needed help, got on our drug rehab program. But it's people that you commonly know that may become homeless, and typically you never think it's going to happen to you. But most people are like one or two paychecks away from being homeless.
I think that became a lot, more people became aware of how many vulnerable people there are after the Great Recession, just because the economic impact was so deep and so rampant.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we see a huge increase of women and children. Like last night, we probably had 90 women and children spend the night with us and about 60 men. And so the vast majority are women and children. And what I think we see are women who do get jobs can barely make ends meet. And so they lose their job. Their car got broken. They get behind in rent. And next thing you know, within a few months, they're homeless. And so I think it's challenging to have like a single income family to be able to support your kids. And so that's why I think we see a huge number of women and children that are coming for assistance.
How many homeless are there in Lansing right now? About?
Mark, that's a great question.
You know,
it's always a definition of homelessness. That's the challenge. But what we're looking for, people that are sheltered and people that are unsheltered. So I'm sure it's in excess of 400 men, women, and children that are homeless. The City Rescue Mission has capacity to shelter nearly half of that 400. We have a facility on Michigan Avenue for our men. We also have a public dining room on Michigan Avenue. Last year, we provided over 100,000 meals. And we also have a facility on South Cedar Street. It was the old Maplewood Elementary School that we renovated a few years ago. And that's where we shelter our women and children.
You have had a spike in your shelter's numbers. You went from 30 to 40 people just a couple of years ago, up to 120.
120,
last fall?
Exactly.
What led to that spike?
I think it's certainly the idea that there's the housing market is difficult, and I think affordable housing is challenging. So to find a job that you can sustain yourself and your family and to be able to sustain yourself, I think, is a challenge. So I think affordable housing is a difficulty. But also we see with the economy, people losing jobs, looking for places to stay, and not be able to maintain their housing. So I think that's the challenge, is maintain the housing.
I would have expected that spike earlier, though, just the way again, maybe I'm harping on the recession too much. But, you know, the economy really did, in some ways, start to turn around a lot sooner than that. But you've seen a real spike really recently.
Well, over the past couple of years, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that if you can't maintain your housing and you can't maintain your job, we see a huge increase of homelessness. But it's not so much that the adult men, we see the women and children that are increasing dramatically. And so if you look at people on cash assistance, Ingham County by example, 96% of the people on cash assistance are single women with kids, 96%. And so those are the women that are very vulnerable to becoming homeless. And so we've seen that increase over the years dramatically, and they're the ones that are most vulnerable to becoming homeless.
Let's talk a little bit more about the stigma of homelessness, the foreclosure crisis, which started about 5 years ago, made untold numbers of people homeless. How has that changed the perspective of homelessness? I mean, is the rest of society altering its view on who homeless people are?
Well, I think segments like this is helpful to educate the public that it's not just adult men, middle-class men, or middle-aged men that are homeless, but it's also women and children that are homeless. So I think people empathize a little bit more when you've been faithfully paying your rent and suddenly your landlord loses his house because he's not making the mortgage payment. We've seen this huge increase over the past couple of years of people like that get red-tagged house because it gets foreclosed on. And so that's a huge increase with people that are becoming homeless.
Okay. What programs are working that help the homeless regain their footing?
The programs is basically organizations working together. City Rescue Mission is the largest shelter in Michigan's capital area, but we work with other agencies to help people get work, get housing. We work with Capital Community Services, by example. They do a great job helping women get first month's rent deposit, do a lot of financial training. Work with Evan House Ministries, by example. We give them free office space to come counsel our guests, to be able to do job counseling, do job applications, and get work, and save up their money and get their own place. And so we work with other agencies. Our core competence as a city rescue mission for 102 years is to share the gospel. It's to feed and to shelter, and we do that very well. But we partner with other agencies to do other things that are important to help people to correct the homeless situation they happen to be in.
Mark Criss is the executive director of the City Rescue Mission in Lansing. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Neighbors in Action is a listener-generated segment here on Current State. It's your chance to produce the show and engage with us and tell our listeners about the great work you, your friends, your neighbors, and your colleagues are doing here in the Lansing area. If you'd like to nominate someone or an organization to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, send us an email. We're at currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. You can even nominate yourself if you like.
I want to help people, and I want to be in a position to. But when you down, the first thing you have to do is stop falling, and then you have to learn how to stand up. So that's what I had to learn, that, you know, the foundation is the most important part, and I want to build a good foundation so that God can use me.
Tomorrow night at 7:30, the BBC Concert Orchestra performs a program of British music at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts. Keith Lockhart is principal conductor of the London-based group. Lockhart is probably best known as the 20th conductor of the Boston Pops. WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with Keith Lockhart a few days ago by phone to preview this week's East Lansing performance. Lockhart started the conversation by noting a busy 2012 for the BBC Concert Orchestra in the wake of the Queen's Jubilee celebration, the Summer Olympics, and a royal birth on the way.
It's been a huge year for them. I always, when I go over there, I'm always saying, so what are you guys doing now? I mean, the Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth on the throne, which of course was a huge worldwide celebration, and I was fortunate enough to be part of that Buckingham Palace concert that was seen all around the world, because that was the BBC Concert Orchestra playing that concert behind Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder and everyone, pretty much. The Olympics, the upcoming, the patter of little royal feet, you're right, it's been a very fun year to be going there and seeing all the excitement.
Can we talk first about Britain and the 4C interludes? These are some of my very favorite pieces, and they come from the opera Peter Grimes, but these pieces are known almost as a sort of a tone poem extracted from the opera.
I'd say if there is an overall feeling through the 4C interludes, and indeed through Peter Grimes, it's a feeling of cold, of dark, clammy cold, the type you might feel if you spent the night huddled on a rocky outcropping on the British coast. The first movement, Dawn, begins with a beautiful evocation of birdsong in the flute and the high violin, and these wonderful, kind of tremendously powerful chords of the brass that well up underneath them, in a way unrelated, different sort of thing that are, the vastness and the ongoing continuity of the sea itself. The second movement, Sunday Morning, is by far the lightest part of the series. It's energetic, it's bustling, it shows the life of a town and the people in it, and it's the closest thing to a scherzo. Movement is one of my favorites in terms of innovation. All of the notes are played as what we call balloon articulation, which is that it's louder in the middle and softer on each end. So everything has this wah, wah, wah sort of sound to it, which to me I think is evocative of the the motion of waves in the moonlight. The last movement is simply, along with the Storm and the Pastoral Symphony and a couple of other moments, I can think of one of the best evocations of the fury of a lashing, violent storm of that has ever been penned. It's tremendously fun, a huge rush, and really a crowd pleaser.
Let's touch briefly on a couple other little pieces by Elgar, certainly two of his best-known works. Let's go to the Enigma Variations first, which are really a musical mystery.
Well, that's I suppose if we knew what the Enigma was, it wouldn't be an Enigma anymore.
Right.
They, of course, are called the Enigma Variations. Elgar certainly encouraged the feeling of the question mark over the piece, but he was quite explicit about who the variations are about. It is a single movement work lasting a little under half an hour that is an original theme. And then variations that, as he told his wife, are in the style that as of, well, various friends. Each one has a friend's initials or a pet name or something over the top of it. Well, how they would have written the theme if they were composers.
Also on the program, another of Elgar's greatest works, his cello concerto, one of his very last works. And probably many classical music fans know that this heart-wrenching piece is very closely associated with a very heart-wrenching real-life story of a great artist.
Well, the concerto was actually popular in its time, languished for, 40 or so years, and had never really hit the international scene as a standard repertory piece until the beautiful young cellist Jacqueline Dupré took it up, became a huge proponent of it. There was a very, very seminal recording of that I think won pretty much every award and every heart. And she fell ill and passed away with a lot of what seemed to be a very promising career unfulfilled. And so, but in a way, this piece, I think, for true classical music fans who date back a bit, will always be associated with her and her stellar interpretation.
K. Keith Lockhart is music director of the Boston Pops. He conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra on January 31st at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Maestro, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time, and I'll see you there.
On tomorrow's Current State, we look back on January's news and issues in the Lansing area. Joining me to discuss them, the Lansing State Journal's editorial page editor Mickey Hurton, City Pulse's Walt Sorg, and MLive's Angela Whitrock. What stories from January would you like our guests to discuss? Current State at WKAR.org. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com.